Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and today I wanted to talk about the Dreamland Realm again. Trying to get through the whole of the Six Kingdoms. So today, I want to talk about the Serenarian Sea. We have been around the Serenarian Sea, or up to the Serenarian Sea. We've not been through the Serenarian Sea, so that's what we're going to cover today. When we were closest to the Serenarian Sea, we were in Kirin or near Thran. And Thran, you might remember, is the big city near the Jasper Temple along the Okranos River. The Okranos River empties out into the Serenarian Sea, presumably. It doesn't say as much in the source text. The source text being, in case you have not heard the previous episodes, the Dream Quest for the Unknown Caedith by H.P. Lovecraft. But it does say that the Serenarian, or the narrator of the book, rather, gets to the Serenarian Sea by way of Thran. And so, eventually, the Okranos goes to some body of water that then turns into the Serenarian Sea. The Serenarian Sea is spelt C-E-R-E-N-E-R-I-A-N, Serenarian Sea. It's a little bit difficult to say, honestly. Especially since in the same text, there is a city, which you might remember hearing about, a cloud city called Serenian, S-E-R-A-N-N-I-A-N. And there is, as far as we know, no relationship whatsoever between the Serenarian Sea and Serenian, the cloud city. Okay, so now that we've got that cleared up, the first stop along the Serenarian Sea is a place called Kled. This is one of my favorite places, because I kind of feel like it's something straight out of Robert E. Howard, Conan the Barbarian, straight out of Edgar Rice Burroughs, Tarzan. It is described as the perfumed jungles of Kled. It's a tropical forest containing an ancient and forgotten kingdom that is completely undecayed and unharmed by the outside world. So it's kept in an undecayed state by spells placed upon it by the Elder Ones. Why did the Elder Ones place preservation or repose in Pathfinder and D&D terminology, repose spells on this kingdom? Well, it is said that it is preserved by the Elder Ones just in case they have need for a jungle kingdom again in the future. So in the forest there are said to be great ivory palaces and cities, where once dwelt fabulous monarchs of a land whose name is forgotten. Elephant caravans have glimpsed these artifacts from afar by moonlight, but none dare approach Kled too closely for fear of the spells and guardians placed upon it. This is begging to be explored. If you are at all into, like I said, Tarzan, or the more jungle-based adventures of the original Conan, or Magic the Gathering, they're at least at the time of this recording, their latest release, the Ixalan setting, or even something like Tomb of Annihilation, where you're going down in 5th edition Dungeons and Dragons and exploring the peninsula of Chult. This is that setting. This is the jungle setting that you've been waiting for, if you're into that. And I think especially with these forgotten cities that are abandoned, presumably, although, I mean, nothing's saying there couldn't be ghosts there, or there's nothing there that says that it can't have been taken over by some species of your choosing. But presumably they're abandoned. Maybe not. Depends. Either way, the cities are there, and they're completely, perfectly preserved, but ancient. So, you know, you can flavor it any way you want, whether you want it to be something that that maybe is a little bit South American flavored, or maybe something a little bit African flavored, or something New Zealand flavored. You know, it, pick your jungle, pick your lush, sort of untrodden forest land, and place it in Kled and go to town. Nothing but fun to be had. It's a territory I would absolutely love to DM for, or to play in, or to write for. It's so romantic and classic. It's definitely one of my favorite barely mentioned realms or regions of the Dreamland realms. Now, since this realm or this region is barely mentioned in the book, I mean, what I read you is basically what it says in the source text. So there's not a whole lot to go off of in terms of what kind of manner of creatures or civilizations you would find here. And I think that's great, because this means that there's a lot of flexibility for you. I mean, there's flexibility anyway, because it's just an idea of a jungle. But that idea of the preserved cities is what really, really interests me, I think. And it would be really cool to see what has moved into those cities and what kind of culture they have formed, removed from all other influences. And to that point, I kind of really love the idea of maybe there being some settlement or some population within this area that maybe has gone off the rails from away from whatever pantheon you're using. And for me, that's generally the Lord Dunsany Pagana pantheon, with a little sprinkling of Egyptian pantheon as necessary. And maybe this population within the forest, again, uninfluenced by anyone else, has come up with some other set of gods, like the pantheon from Porphyra, for instance. And specifically, I'm thinking of this goddess who I don't think we've covered in this series yet. Maybe we have. I don't think so. She's a neutral goddess, and her name is Chuta. And she's a goddess of a river, and her favorite animal is a crocodile. But one of her domains, coincidentally, is repose. And I've always seen her kind of as a river, as a forest goddess for some reason, although she's really, as written, it's more that she's interested in rivers. But, I mean, rivers happen in forests, so it works. But her followers, one of their rituals is to bury the injured or the dead or something in mud, and then they raise up to heal them or something like that. I forget exactly what it is, but it's very ritualistic around the water, and she seems like a very nature-centric goddess, and I could just see her being something that a community within this preserved jungle region would have found for themselves, and that could be very cool, because she'd be outside of your normal pantheon. And in terms of the animal life, you could go several different directions. You know, you could just open up any given bestiary or monster manual, whatever you have lying around. I just grabbed one. But yeah, you could have the sort of the weird, you know, with from the 5th edition, for instance. Here's a Kuotoa, a kind of sort of a fish-like person. You could have a Tabaxi, which we've talked about previously, those sort of cat-like people. You could definitely have, for instance, lizard folk. I think all of those things would kind of fit into a jungle setting. Or you could go more classic and have things like the, you know, any normal jungle creature, only worse, right? Like, so instead of just having a gorilla, although you could do that, the Pathfinder bestiary has an entry for a gorilla, I know that off the top of my head, but you could do a dire ape, because certainly in Lovecraft and Edgar Rice Burroughs both just loved to have one of their primary monsters was an ape a lot of times. Like, they just love to pull out the ape monster. What else? You could have, like, well, obviously leopards and panthers and stuff like that, but you could go darker and, you know, dark fantasy too. So you could have, like, owl harpies, and moss lurkers, and treants, weird creature. Well, obviously assassin vines. You could have the plants themselves rise up against your players. So, yeah, I think the jungle is just such a great. It's sort of like this, any jungle, but this one, because it's preserved and it's magical. It's basically a dungeon. Except it's not, you know, your players won't think of it as a dungeon because they're outside. They're not in a dungeon, but they are. They really are. Okay, so further down the, or actually further up, I think, along the Serenarian Sea, I believe it sounded to me from the source text like this city called Hlanith, H-L-A-N-I-T-H. It's a vast trading city, and it sounds to me like it's sort of situated near the outlet of the Okhranos River out into the Serenarian Sea. So a little bit like Dilith Lean sits at the outlet of the sky into the Southern Sea, I think Hlanith sits on that same kind of position of here's the river into the larger body of water and will be the trading city where those two things meet. Because, it makes sense. That's the impression I got from the text. So Hlanith is made of surrounded by big granite walls, and the houses peak fantastic with beamed and plastered gables along the city. And the men of Hlanith are more like those of the waking world than any other in Dreamland. So the city is not all that popular except to barter, which, that's what you do in a trading city, so that works. But it's prized for its solid work of its artisans. The wharves of Hlanith are of oak, and the streets are rutted by the wooden ox carts that lumber along as feverish merchants cry out to advertise their wares in the bazaars of the city. Sea taverns populate cobbled lanes, salted with the spray of high tides along the wharves. They're exceedingly ancient, with their low, black-beamed ceilings and casements of greenish bull's-eye panes, and ancient sailors in those taverns talk much of distant ports and tell many stories of the curious men from Twilight Inquinock. Inquinock. What is that? Well, we'll find out later. But yeah, Hlanith is, it's a trading city, obviously. People go there to trade. Not very popular to hang out. Just kind of, it's a nice place to visit, in other words. You wouldn't want to stay there. And the reason you wouldn't want to stay there, from what I get from the source text, is that it's a bit mundane. It's old and mundane. It's just not fantastical. It's not like the rest of the Dreamland realm. The people there probably talk about real-world problems, like boring things, like paying taxes and stuff. They don't talk about going on quests and things like that. So it's a mundane city. Here's a place that's not mundane. Selephais. Now, Selephais is a pretty important place in the Lovecraft universe because it gets mentioned not just in the source text that I'm concentrating on, the Dream Quest of the Unknown for the Unknown Cadeth, but it's actually a story of its own. It's a short story all of its own, and in this short story, a guy named Kuranes, K-U-R-A-N-E-S, witnesses this marvelous city in a dream and sort of ends up kind of claiming it as his own. He becomes the leader of Selephais, the ruler of this place. The place broadly is Uthnargai. Uthnargai is the region where Selephais is situated on the ground, and above the ground, above all of this, is a cloud-fashioned city called Serenarian. No, sorry, not Serenarian. Serenian. S-E-R-A-N-N-I-A-N. Now, Kuranes holds court alternately in both of in these two places, Selephais and in Serenian. Or at least he did. That's how he ended up in the I guess that's a spoiler. But anyway, it is revealed that he does rule in both places. He holds court alternately in both locations in the story by that title, Selephais. In the Dreamland, in the Cadeth story, by that time, Kuranes has moved out of both locations, and he's moved kind of nearby in the hills and has a little city that he maintains, or a town that he maintains because he misses home, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But within the within the walls of Sedefeus itself. And I get from this book and from the story by the same title, I get that Sedefeus is probably, for all intents and purposes, the capital city of Uthnargai. And if not, I mean, I don't suppose that the concept of a capital city doesn't even apply here, but it is the center of that kingdom. And as I think I mentioned in a previous episode, I think that when Lovecraft refers to six kingdoms of the Dreamlands, I think that this is probably certainly that this has to be one of them. Uthnargai has got to be one of them. And Kled, I think, is probably another. But I've already said enough about Kled. It's one paragraph. Sedefeus sits at the foot of the great Mount Man, M-A-N, and the snowy peak of Aran, A-R-A-N, with its ginkgo trees swaying on its lower slopes, and below that are visible the glittering minarets, the citadel, the untarnished marble walls, and bronze statues of the marvelous city of Sedefeus. From the port, you can see a great stone bridge where the river Naraxa joins the sea, the Serenarian Sea. Surrounding the city are gentle hills with groves and gardens of asphodels and the small shrines of cottages upon them, and far in the background, the purple ridge of the Tenarians, which is a mountain range, or whatever you call a mountain range when it consists mainly of hills. So rolling hills of the Tenarians, potent and mystical, behind which lay forbidden ways into the waking world and toward other regions of dream. So this kind of this blows the cover of Lovecraft's Dreamland realm, because early in the story, in the source text of Kadeth, he says that he can't tell us where all the locations that the Dreamland realm touches, you know, sort of intersects the our plane of existence. And I think so far he's told us every single place that this happens. Maybe he doesn't tell us where the ghouls get off to when they come up into the graveyards. That might be one secret that remains. But yeah, so in the Enchanted Wood and then behind the Tenarian hills are portals into our realm, into our plane of existence. So bear that in mind if you're ever stuck in the Six Kingdoms. The harbor has spice-fragrant wharves. It is usually full of gloriously painted galleons, some from the marble cloud city of Serranion that lies in ethereal space beyond where the sea meets the sky, and others from more substantial parts of Dreamland. Now, some people claim that Sedefeus inherits a little bit of Kled's mystical youthfulness. In other words, some of the spell, the magic that the elder ones have placed on the jungle city, kind of bleeds over into Sedefeus, and that it's a deathless city of vision, and that time has no power to tarnish or destroy the town. Because it is especially beautiful at night, and its street lamps and houses light up the streets as well as the surrounding waters of Naraxa and the Serenarian. Adding to the beauty of the city and the mythos that Sedefeus isn't really affected by time as much as the rest of the Six Kingdoms is the temple Nathhorthath and the 80 orchid-wreathed priests, who are the same who built it 10,000 years ago, legend has it. Shining still is the bronze of the great Sedefeus gates, and its onyx pavements are never worn or broken, and the great bronze statues on the walls look down on merchants and camel drivers older than fable, yet without one gray hair in their forked beards. So there's definitely some magic going on in this city. It's not explained. It is presented as rumor or as, local legend, but if we are to believe the narrator, we get the sense that it's actually true, that there is truth to this, that some magic does bleed over from the jungle and affect the area with a certain timelessness. Thoraborian merchants, traders from Rhynar and Ogrothan and Inconach, and people from all over come to trade in the bazaars of Sedefeus, Local treasures include carved jade, spun gold, and little red singing birds common in the region. So the temple, Nathor Thoth, there's a famous Street of the Pillars, is what it's called, Street of the Pillars, leads through Seliphas to the turquoise temple of the god Nathor Thoth. I do not know from anywhere whether Nathor Thoth is a reference to Thoth, or if it just bears a similar end sound, Nathor Thoth. To me, to my ears, that's a remix of the Egyptian god Thoth, the Ibis god, the guy who is sort of lord of knowledge and so on. But it could be anyone, Nathor Thoth. But I get that he's a fairly benevolent god or goddess. I don't know really what it is, but I don't get any sense of evil. And Nathor Thoth is kind of a local deity, chiefly worshipped in Seliphas, but all the great ones are mentioned in the diurnal prayers of all of those priests of that temple. So that's why I don't get that it's an evil, kind of jealous god. It seems to be a pretty open, friendly god. The temple's priests wear crowns of orchids and offer spiritual advice to visitors. Are there cats in Seliphas? That's, you've got to ask about the cats if you're talking about Lovecraft. So, yes, there are a group of cats, and there's an old chief cat in Seliphas near the sheep butchers in the bazaar, specifically. There's a gray and most dignified cat. He's kind of the patriarch of the area, well, among the cats anyway, and he can usually be found sunning himself on the onyx pavement. He will not speak to you without a password and an introduction from dignitaries of Ulthar or other trusted feline champions. So don't even try unless you've made friends with the Ulthar cats and gotten a recommendation to go seek him out. It's pointless to try to talk to him. But he is there. Once his trust has been earned, the patriarch cat will happily reveal secret lore known only to the cats on the seaward slopes of Uthnargai. This cat is also friends with King Kuranes. So let's talk a little bit about King Kuranes. Oh, the cat, I guess, in terms of stats and stuff, there is that great, I'm just going to just kind of remind you about it. There's that fantastic temple cat from the Tome of Beasts by Kobold Press. It's just one of my favorite entries into the Tome of Beasts. It just, for some reason, it sticks with me. It's the Bastet temple cat as written, but you could certainly reuse the stat block and probably some of the lore, because it's just such a great little, it's a great little beast. It has multi-attack, but what I really like about it, I mean, I don't see why anyone would be fighting this chief, although he could be a companion and help fight, so that actually could be important. But what I really like about this cat is that they literally give him, unless I'm making this up, they literally give him 9 lives. Fascinating lure, yeah, that's when he tricks you. Yeah, maybe I'm making that up. I swear in my headcanon that this cat had 9, like, actual 9 lives. Oh, maybe, you know what it was? It was the 9d6. So it's like tip of the hat to 9 lives, I imagine. But yeah, maybe there's another cat in another bestiary that they actually give them 9 lives. Or maybe I would just give a cat 9 lives. Either way, that's the chief cat. So let's talk about King Kuranes. So depending on who you believe, King Kuranes reigns in either the Rose Crystal Palace of the 70 Delights at Seliphas, or in the turreted cloud castle of sky-floating Saranian. Of course, we know from a separate story that King Kuranes actually rules over both. He is, he holds court alternately in each city. I don't know what his schedule is, but he does rule over both. But, like I say, by the time that this source text happens, the search for the unknown Caedith happens, he has become unhappy with palace life, and he has moved on finding himself longing for the cliffs and downlands of his boyhood spent in Britain. So he moved from either Saranian or Selafes into the eastern Tanarian countryside, where he built a replica of a Cornish fishing village. Not brick by brick, but he commissioned, you know, his subjects, probably, to build this replica of a Cornish fishing village. So Kirani's fishing village is populated by locals who've been ordered to mimic the accents of Cornwall fishers, and their songs linger throughout the evening behind lattice windows, and there's a gray church tower that peeps through the verdure of distant valleys, just like in his old hometown. Kranis himself dwells in a gray Gothic manor house of stone, looking out upon the sea, and he pretends that it's the ancient Trevor Towers where he was born and where 13 generations of his forefathers had first seen the light. On the coast nearby dwells his Cornish fishing village itself, with steep cobbled ways, and in a valley not far off he commissioned the Norman Abbey, whose towers he can see from his window. Around the churchyard there are gray stones with the names of his ancestors carved thereupon, and with moss somewhat like old England's moss growing on them. Of course, no one's actually buried there, or at least his family isn't buried there, but he has a mock graveyard there. And Kiranis is an interesting character. He's great. I mean, you should, if you're interested in Kiranis, you should probably read the Selafes short story. It doesn't really go all that much into his personality, really. I mean, Lovecraft, again, I think I've said this before, Lovecraft manages to write amazing amounts of information about sort of just cities, really. Just usually empty cities. Very, very often he describes just the city itself. It's amazing the amount of work he's done just describing cities. It really is. Or castles. Sometimes it's castles. But yeah, he can go on and on about it, and you just don't get tired of it. It's really, really quite neat. But Kiranis is an interesting guy, because so he's kind of a bit of a dreamer, you know. His mind wanders. He's got a good imagination, and he discovered Selafes in his exploration of the Dreamland realms, and ended up ruling over Uthnagai. And then he got kind of homesick for old England, and obviously recreated this village to make himself feel at home. And he commissions people to act like British people, and that's what he does. But when he talks to the narrator, he kind of advises the narrator to stop adventuring, you know, it's like, just stop going on this quest and just really appreciate the time that you have on Earth, and appreciate the things that you love, because at some point you're going to lose them. It's kind of, there's a sad beauty to Kiranis and to his outlook on life, because it is a little bit dismal. It's a little bit sad, and I don't know. He's definitely a candidate for being a wise old confidant, but he could easily be twisted into someone evil, who maybe wants to get off of this plane and into some other plane of existence for whatever reason, and who knows what. To what horrible ends he might have to go in order to make that happen. Okay, so I think our last stop for this episode, at least, because the Serenarian Sea, being one of the final landmarks in the source text, kind of leads on to some really important further regions that I couldn't describe in one episode. So we'll stop here in the Jagged Isle. And this is only part of the story about the Jagged Isle. But the Jagged Isle is an island of jagged granite located in the Serenarian Sea. It's a good 20 days by boat from Selafes. So it's not just like an island off the coast. It's way the heck out there. And it's a great big island with these granite pinnacles that claw almost at the dull northern sky. And so the north, as you go further north in the Dreamland realms, it kind of gets duller and dimmer and darker. And there's this almost a feeling that if you keep going north, you're going to drop off the face of the plane. You're going to fall off the end of the world. And to some degree, I think there is precedence for that, because in order to get off of this plane into somewhere else, the narrator just keeps going north. So I think there is kind of the suggestion that if you keep going north, you do run out of realm. The sides of the rock of the island are impossibly steep, but on ledges here and there can be seen these bulging walls of queer windowless dwellings, and the low railings guarding traveled high roads. Sailors decline to even give this island a name, and no one ever seeks it out, and they actively avoid it. And at night, ceaseless howling is said to arise from the island, and all the ships hurry past it. Now, this is probably all legend. It's probably not a big deal. It's probably just the wind. Although, if you do look at the island and you see these big bulging windowless houses, that might make you think of something if you've heard previous episodes about the Dreamland realm. And if it makes you think of the moon, then you would be correct, because yes, so this island is actually inhabited by a colony of a remote colony of moon beasts and their slaves coming down from the moon, inhabiting this island up to no good. No one knows exactly what they are up to, but we can assume that they are up to no good. On the southern side of the island are prolongations of the island forming headlands so steep that only one ship at a time can fit through. So it's kind of well, you know, its little harbor is pretty well guarded just by natural formations. Through this flume-like strait lays stagnant and putrid a great harbor, which is it's kind of a concealed entry to the wharves of the bustling port city that these moon beasts have set up there. In the harbor, there is a forbidding stone quay, a loading site for crates and boxes containing nameless and fabulous horrors. These get hitched to lumbering lorries taking cargo up into the small stone town hewn out of the vertical cliff above the wharves. Now, the town above the wharves that is cre you know that's literally made out of the rock is it predates the moon beast colony. They didn't cr they may have made part of it, but there was some settlement there in the far, far, far past. The island itself is just an outpost for moon beasts, and it seems to be kind of a I can't figure out really from reading whether it's a midway point for for their activities on Earth, or whether it is actually a destination on Earth that they are supplying and trying to grow. What we do know is that they hang out there a lot. They've got a pretty good infrastructure set up. They bring goods into the city, and they bring slaves into the city. They hang out in their little windowless buildings and crypt-like array of dwellings. And if you explore this strange place, you'll find remnants of all kinds of unholy experimentation. And by remnants, I mean sometimes half-alive creatures, or maybe things that aren't yet alive. You know, you get kind of the sense of kind of a maybe a Frankenstein style sort of experimentation, evil mad scientist sort of setup, where you've got these creatures that you can't really tell. Was it something that was alive and was just beaten to a pulp, or is it something that they're creating and might come to life any moment and attack me? It's up to anybody's guess, really. And there are workshops with grotesque furnishings carved from moon trees, painted with frantic and chaotic designs. The purposes of implements that you find are unknown, but moon beasts are known to be fond of torture, so you can kind of draw your own conclusions. There are countless weapons, implementations, and ornaments throughout, including hoghead distillers of moon wine, treasure, and some large idols of solid ruby depicting beings that are definitely not of this earth. And we know that ruby comes from the moon, so we assume that these are religious icons that the moon beasts have brought with them. The upper parts of the rock city holds more temples than private homes, and in numerous hewn chambers there are terrible carven altars, stained fonts, and shrines for the worship of things more monstrous than even the strangest of the earth gods. From the rear of one of the great temples there stretches a low black passage, which itself leads to a lightless domed hall of vast proportions with vaultings that are covered with demoniac carvings. In the center of this yawns a foul and bottomless well, like that in the hideous monastery of Leng, which we haven't gone to yet, but we'll see it later. Past this great well is a small door of strangely wrought bronze that strikes fear into any adventurer approaching it. So when I hear this, you know, just the obvious dungeon imagination just goes wild. I mean, it's just a small bronze door that strikes fear into your heart when you approach it. I mean, that's okay. So definitely impose some kind of saving throw to resist fear from this portal. And then who knows where it leads? And then you've got this bottomless well, and who knows what's in the bottomless well? And wouldn't you like to find out? And the city does have a history. It is said very explicitly that there was some civilization that dwelt here before the moon beasts took it over. I don't get the impression that the moon beasts came in and performed a coup. I get that the civilization that was once there was already gone, and that the moon beasts then moved in. Now, I could be wrong, but I kind of feel like if the moon beasts, or the moon beings, whatever they're called, had moved in and taken things over, I think they would have retained slaves from that civilization, because that seems to be more their style. So I get that it was an ancient civilization, so ancient that it is not a thing anymore, and wasn't a thing when they got there. So you've got these remnants, this sort of ghost echo of a past civilization, lurking under a city that is being used for unspeakable evil. It's just a perfect combination for all kinds of drama. I mean, you could have either the spirit of the past civilization starting to collude with the moon beasts or the moon beings, or you could have the ghosts rebelling against the moon beings. I mean, you could flip it depending on how your players end up going. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, I have to mention that around the island, or within the, you know, in the harbor, or just outside the harbor, maybe, of this island, there dwells a very large, very unnatural, unholy sea creature. We don't ever get a description of it, so you'll just have to make up your own. It being Lovecraft, you kind of want it to be some tentacled monster. There's a really fantastic Krake spawn in the Tome of Beasts by Kobold Press. But, I mean, you could just look for any Kraken in any bestiary, and I'm sure it would do. Or you could do your own thing and have it be something different. But the Krake spawn in the Tome of Beasts is a demonic crossbreed. So it's not just a squid, it's a devil squid. It says, some believe Krake spawn are demonic crossbreeds created by the Aboleth, fusing Kraken blood with demonic souls. Others say that the Krake spawn are the horrible creation of a long-forgotten meddling god summoned to this mortal world by Deep Ones. Certainly, Krake spawn do respond to summoning magic, and sorcerers do summon Krake spawn through blood sacrifices to work evil in the world. I mean, I think that would do it for me, honestly. If I was looking for a big sea creature with a dark past for my big evil island with a dark present and a questionable past, this would be perfect. It's a huge monstrosity. It is neutral evil, as defined in the Tome of Beasts. Armor class 16, hit points 150. Not too shabby. And they give it a challenge rating of 9. So, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not like an ancient dragon, but it's pretty good. It's not too shabby. And it's got multi-attack for bite, for tentacle. it has a constrict attack where it can grab something and then squeeze it, and then a vomit from the deeps once per day. The Krake spawn sprays half-digested food from its maw over a 15-foot cone. This acidic slurry causes 3 1d6 acid damage, and targets must make a successful DC 18 constitution saving throw or be incapacitated until the end of their next turn. I love that one. It's really fantastic. That whole book is fantastic, but that one just fits so perfectly into what I needed it for. It was really just kind of perfect. And that's where we'll stop for now. We have seen some really beautiful places. We've seen a horrific, evil, mad scientist island that's been taken over by moon beings. And it kind of gets more evil the more north you go. So we'll just stop here because the northerner we go, the more it starts to tie in together, and it's a little bit harder to break it up. Plus, I think this episode's probably been going for like an hour. So yeah, that's everything about not everything. That's much of the Serenarian Sea in the Dreamlands realm. Thank you very much for listening. Talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.